Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files RTFM episode. Read the fucking manual. We are joined by I haven't even introduced Fintan. I'm a bad person. I know that. I'm a bad person. Fintan, hi.
Hey, John.
How are
you? Thanks for remembering me. I appreciate that.
It's like kicking a puppy.
It really is. It really
and
is.
Not in a good way.
There's a good puppy kicking way.
I don't want to go into that right now. We don't want to go down that particular rabbit hole. But let's just say my kids are very well behaved. I'm obviously kidding. What's the news from Holland?
Well, outside my window, there's a big crash on the motorway. This isn't a metaphor for my week. It's actually a crash. And I'm watching the traffic backed up, and so if you hear some sirens, it's just some ambulances going to cut people out of a car or whatever has just happened. So yeah,
well, that's great news. We're joined today by Robin Fetterman and Amy McBride, who are program managers for the Northeast Problem Gambling Resource Center. That's in the United States. But I guess one of the questions that we could ask today is, are those states in fact united? Robin and Amy, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Are your states united?
I like to think they are.
Yeah, I like to think so too.
Yeah, I like to think I'm 6 feet tall. I'm really not.
Well, I'm 5'11".
Well, it's all right for you then.
It is. I would like to say, John, on behalf of, although I don't know if I should speak on behalf of the whole United States, but I would like to say that as far as gambling goes and problem gambling, each state definitely follows the other, and we pay attention to what the rest of the states are doing. We try to have, you know, similarities. I know that we're all here for one common goal, and that's to support people that are negatively impacted by gambling, whether they have an addiction, whether they have a family member who their gambling has gotten out of hand. So as far as that goes, we're all united.
New York was a relatively early market opening up in this sort of recent wave. And by all means, stop me if I'm wrong at any time, because I frequently am. Have you found that you have been blazing any trails in terms of how you've approached your project? Have people been looking to you for sort of guidance with theirs?
Oh, well, I would say absolutely. You know, I might be a little biased, but I would say here in New York, and at least with the program that Robin and I work for and what we've created here in New York, to my knowledge, there isn't anything else like it in the country. Just the level of support that we're able to offer to New Yorkers, it doesn't exist in other states. So I feel like what we're doing is, you know, really, I like to say, groundbreaking. I just think it's incredible how many folks we're able to help across the state of New York. Folks reach out for help for themselves. They have a concern about a loved one. They reach out to us. We can get them help. We're able to turn around, get someone into some sort of treatment option, typically within a week. So I think, you know, just the amount of people we're able to help, the amount of resources and support, and I think the way we approach what we're doing as well, just with care and concern.
Well, let's take a little bit of a step back here and look at what you do, how you do it, but what you cover as well. So what gambling is legal in New York State? What are you covering as a result of that?
Well, there's definitely different types of gambling and gambling expansion currently happening as well in New York State. I would say, you know, speaking for our resource center and what we're hearing and seeing, we have horse racing. There's, more of like a brick and mortar gaming facility like casinos. There's OTB or off-track betting. We get calls in the resource center about, you know, scratch-offs or scratchers. So, you know, the New York State Lottery system, you know, we get calls in about that. And then, you know, what's really starting to grow is sports gambling. And that's now being expanded in New York State for mobile sports betting. So we're definitely anticipating an increase in calls for help to our resource center for mobile sports betting.
How are you funded?
Sure. So we are grant funded by the Office of Addiction Supports and Services. That's a New York State program. So our grant funds are able to provide treatment for people regardless of ability to pay, which is a great thing because obviously people coming in with a gambling issue might be low on finances. But the great news is treatment's available to them and family members, and our grant funds can cover the cost if we can't help with insurance.
I know this is going to sound like I'm a typical European, but I'm genuinely surprised that it's not means tested in any way and open to everybody, because, you know, the obviously the healthcare in the US and the insurance based system and all of that, it just looks bonkers to the rest of us. So there's no funding coming from the gambling operator side at all?
Well, it's the way that it's funded. So, I can't speak in great detail, but to sort of sum up, the different entities do pay taxes on, to have their gaming license. That tax money then goes to New York State. And then, you know, where Robin was talking about our funding coming from OASIS, New York State tax dollars do go towards that state agency of OASIS, and then the funds are filtered down to various agencies such as ours.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
No, it does make sense. It's just in the UK, part of licensing, if I remember correctly, is that a percentage of I think it's percentage of profits rather than turnover, but it's only a small percentage of profits, but a percentage of profits is allocated to fund problem gambling charities and treatments, et cetera.
Yeah. Which, and that's similar in the sense in New York State, the operators do pay, do have to pay a percentage, just the way that the funding streams come down to the treatment of various agencies sounds different. So we don't necessarily get funds directly from, the folks, the different gaming facilities. It goes to the state and then is filtered out accordingly.
So you're a state-run organization?
No, we're a nonprofit agency. So our funding is from a state agency. OASIS
right,
is a state
thing,
agency.
Sorry. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no worries. It's confusing.
Well, most things in America are confusing to Europeans.
Well, I can't speak for all of Americans, but, you know, I find some things in European countries confusing as well. So it sounds like we both need to travel more.
Yes.
There are so many confusing things in Europe you wouldn't believe. I'm just racking.
You should go see firsthand.
In the Netherlands, when you order a coffee, you'll get a little biscuit with it. And there'll be absolute uproar if you don't provide a biscuit.
I think that's something we should adopt in America. That sounds amazing.
Hold on, chaps. What kind of biscuit?
Well, it depends. This is the great thing about it. They come in these little wrappers, and you don't know what type of biscuit you've got. So it's like a biscuit lottery.
Wow.
You end up drinking a lot of coffee, and I realize that I should just buy the biscuits.
If you have a guest at your home and you don't serve them a little biscuit, do they kick off?
I'd be bitterly disappointed. I would judge, and I would question friendships.
Do you judge based on the quality of the biscuit as well, though?
No, you could never do that. It's like judging the quality of if somebody hands you a beer. All you can judge is it cold enough? You can't judge it. It's like one of the bro code rules. You can't judge like, oh, it's a cheap beer or it's an expensive beer. You just have to be grateful for the beer. but then you're judging your host on how cold the beer is.
Okay.
That's how it works. So you can't judge the biscuit. It's the fact the biscuit's been supplied.
Just thinking that if you're in a British hotel room, you're likely to find a biscuit in a wrapper in your room, and it's going to be usually one of two types of biscuit. It will either be shortbread, regardless of how close you are to Scotland, or a Lotus Biscoff.
Yeah, yeah.
And like whenever it's the Lotus Biscoff, I do a happy dance. But I'm easily pleased. I set a low bar for my day.
So what I would love to know, Amy and Robin, is my background is very much kind of the online gambling industry side of things. So there's obviously the new legislation, and the licensees have been announced for the online sports betting. So I think there's 9 licensees, and it's due to go live Q1, all going well. And what's notable about the New York process compared to other states is the high tax rate. So what I was curious is what you would expect to happen is, you know, there's already announcements made about sponsorship deals of the various big sports teams. And you could imagine a big advertising ramp up in the state when things go live. And obviously one of the side effects of all this is that there's obviously going to be an increase in demand for your services. Is this something that you guys are involved with at a planning? Like, are you ready for this, or is it going to be we have to wait and see what happens, or funding lags behind your demand? Like, how do you guys navigate this? Because obviously you're at the coalface of it.
Well, yeah,
that's a great question. You want to take this one, Robin? Go for it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, actually, we are getting ready for it. So just to backtrack, our resource center is a program of the New York Council on Problem Gambling, and they work on the statewide initiatives while we work more at the local level. So on November 1st, New York Council on Problem Gambling launched a brand new campaign called People, Purpose, and Passion, the Pathway to Success. And so what this is we have recommendations that we're going to be offering up to state representatives to kind of put a plan in place to protect those who are going to be vulnerable to having an issue with the expansion of gambling. So, you know, there's a bunch of recommendations that we're rolling out. We just had a big reveal yesterday and had about 115 people attend. But again, it was just to talk about what we expect to happen. You know, we've been paying attention to neighboring states, different countries like Australia. So, you know, we know that with online gambling, especially the accessibility, there's going to be an increase in problems. We're talking about, you know, 285% increase in problem gambling and calls specific to sports gambling increased in Australia 66%. Same with New Jersey, rates doubled as soon as they legalized sports betting and pushed it out online. So we expect these things to happen in our state. We stand ready with a list of recommendations. We're hoping to get the ear of, you know, congressmen and other people so that we can put a safer plan into place and be ahead of the curve to get people treatment services. One of those things being one of the recommendations is that we're hoping they'll change the law and 3% of state revenues can go towards problem gambling services. So we're just kind of asking for, you know, equal representation where marketing is concerned. Less than 1% of funds for right now go to problem gambling advertising of services. So again, we're just asking for an increase in 3% of revenue to go towards counter marketing. So, you know, we have just fair representation out there saying, you know, if gambling's no longer fun for you, there's services that can help you, and here's how you can find us.
Is the funding increase likely? I mean, is it with gambling being kind of the hot topic right now, the license is being issued and it's all imminent. Do you think this is going to happen?
Well, we're certainly advocating for it. You know, we don't have a crystal ball. We're really hopeful that, you know, folks in the state are listening and, you know, we're, like Robin said, our parent agency, the New York Council on Problem Gambling, you know, has been fortunate enough to have a seat at the table and to be making recommendations. So it's, you know, at this point in time, it's a wait and see. And we're just we're doing our best on our end with the program side of things, just preparing to help folks, because as you know, as things expand, the problems are going to increase. And we do take a neutral stance on gambling. I'm not sure if we had said that at the beginning. We're not for or against it. We're just here to help anyone that is negatively impacted by problem gambling.
And to that effect, Amy, I would also say, so what Amy and I do specifically is we've been working really hard over the last year to build up our network of providers. So these are problem gambling treatment specialists. We're trying to just increase the capacity to meet the need that we expect to happen.
What's the sort of split between, you know, what are the I don't know how to phrase this really. What are the things that you see more of people having an issue with? You know, are there specific areas, you know, do you see more people beginning their issue with horse racing? Is it the online gambling that you see more of an issue of? Is there anything that sort of stands out?
Well, we get the whole gamut, really. And, you know, I'm assuming you're not familiar with New York State and, you know, the different areas of the state. But for where we are in the Northeast, we cover what's called 15 counties. So we have a couple cities. We have some more rural areas. We have suburbs. So we have all these different pockets that look completely different. So one of our counties is, you know, has, you know, a really big horse racing culture. So when we get calls in from that county, it's not uncommon for people to call in for problem gambling related to horse racing. But it really is, you know, very different. Every caller, you know, is coming in with a different set of issues, but we're really anticipating with this increase in sports gambling, you know, we've already started to see an uptick in calls related to that. So just really anticipating that to be an increasing issue as that it keeps expanding.
The word expanding came up a couple of times there. Something that I've seen raised on various platforms, and it does certainly, you know, bear discussion. The markets are opening very, very fast in the US. And I'm guessing that your group didn't start up overnight, and you've had to grow to and develop and kind of refine your offering to be as effective as you possibly can. What are your thoughts on is it possible that the markets are opening up almost too quickly for people to be ready and prepared to help the people that might develop a problem?
Well, that's a great question. It's very valid. You know, it's hard to say. You know, Robin and I have been with the council just over 3 years now, and you know, we were very much part of this grassroots effort of, you know, starting to connect folks to treatment in the state of New York. But the council's been around since the 70s, and you know, our executive director Jim Maney was just saying yesterday that he's never seen, you know, an expansion to this scale happening as rapidly as what's going on now. So you know, it's never been, you know, expansion has never been happening this rapidly ever. So you know, it's hard to say, you know, what it's going to look like and how to, you know, again, we have recommendations on how to best prepare for New York State, because we have seen sort of what's happening in other states like New Jersey with the expansion of different platforms for gambling and just the increase in problems and what that looks like. So as Robin said, you know, we have recommendations such as, you know, just putting some safeguards in place for our vulnerable populations like youth. You know, we're concerned that that's going to be, you know, something they're they're seeing more. You can't turn on a football game without seeing some advertisements for gambling. So, you know, how are we going to counter that? So that's just something we want to think about as we're expanding, is, you know, how are we going to protect those vulnerable populations?
Of course. So, I mean, counter programming is, it's great in theory, but you know, the amount of money that, that from our side of the fence goes into the promotion of, and the timing of those promotions is quite extraordinary. I would imagine that for a non-profit organization, it's going to be very difficult to counter program. Not that I'm trying to sound negative, as I say, may have mentioned earlier before we were recording, my glass is definitely half full. It's just a question of what it's half full of.
Sure. Well, again, you know, it's much easier to do those counters when there's funding in place. So the dollars do speak, you know, volumes. If there's money to do some of that counter advertising, to do some of that prevention education in schools, we can definitely be better prepared.
Okay. So something that really, really interests me. Actually, I'm going to take a little step back and explain why it interests me. Certainly in the UK, but in most places, the argument for and against gambling is very polar, I think is the polite way of saying it. And there is, yeah, on the one hand, we've got people saying, no, it's terrible, it's evil, I had a horrible time, it should be banned. And on the other hand, people saying, usually from within the industry, saying, well, yeah, but hang on, you can't make a decision for everybody because you had a shit time.
Sure.
Both valid in their own way for their own reasons. But my personal feeling is that that polarity is getting us precisely nowhere. And I think one of the issues for the industry is that gambling is, A, it's a really easy target, but B, and I think this is really important, gambling is, and honestly, if you go, because you guys are, as Fintan said, you're at the coalface, so if I'm talking out of my ass, do say. But it's kind of, it's more often than not a symptom of a greater ill, rather than something that exists in isolation. And so while it's laid at the feet of the gambling industry that you've got to do this, you've got to do that, the gambling industry is never going to be able to do anything meaningful to tackle this without a whole bunch of other stuff that they have zero experience of and zero knowledge of in most cases.
Sure.
Do you see where I'm going with that?
I think so.
Yeah, well.
Okay, so it's looking at it as a holistic set of treatments, and I'm guessing that with the way you guys have been talking and having other agencies involved with in treatment programs, et cetera, that might be exactly what you do.
Yeah, that hits the nail on the head. We do. What we really, as Robin was saying, with our clinical network, for example, we work with private practitioners that have extensive training to treat problem gambling, and they, you know, they run their own practice, and they take different approaches to treatment. And for some folks, that might look like, you know, setting goals to reduce their gambling. For other people, you know, they may seek out more of an intense inpatient type treatment for problem gambling. Other folks come in, they don't want counseling. They want to, you know, they want to work with peers and do something more like a Gamblers Anonymous approach where, you know, they're with a group of peers, you know, who understand firsthand the struggles that they're going through. So again, for the program manager side of things, where Robin and I, you know, help these callers at the end of the day, we're just trying to meet people where they're at and offer them different services, because there isn't one size fits all for any type of treatment for problem gambling.
I was talking to I'm sorry, Robin, were you going to say something there?
That's okay. Yeah. Well, I was just going to add to that too. You know, as far as New York law goes, and as it stands now, I mean, the New York Council on Problem Gambling, I mean, we have rolled out some best practice standards. So, you know, proposed rules and regulations require, you know, these gaming licensees to develop a problem gambling plan. So we don't know yet. We haven't seen how the applicants for mobile sports betting, how they're going to outline, implement, or manage any of the risks that are associated with the use of their platforms. But we do very actively, we're trying to encourage them to work together with New York State government and the council to create a comprehensive plan that's really going to prioritize protecting New Yorkers, you know, because this is such a new gambling arena, especially with, you know, just the mobile sports betting and just mobile gambling and gaming in general. I mean, it's just uncharted territory. And like I said, I think I said this in the very beginning. I mean, we've been paying attention, you know, abroad, what's going on, other states that have legalized before us. So again, we have this comprehensive plan. We're hoping to build up infrastructure that's going to support expansion. It's a 4-year plan. It's very detailed. So again, I would just encourage, you know, gaming facilities, the state, like we have a plan and we're willing to work with people if they'd like to listen to what we have to offer. We should say we do try to work hand in hand with the gaming and gambling industry to just promote responsible play as a goal.
Interesting you mentioned about other states there, because one of my questions is about, I'm just going to use the name that I use for her, Judge Cheryl.
Cheryl
yes. Moss.
She's a good friend of ours.
The very same. Now, obviously what Judge Cheryl pioneered in Nevada is, I mean,
gambling
speaking
treatment
of somebody
court.
In the industry, it's genius. It's proper, genuine genius. The court. Thank you, Amy. But it's practical, it's realistic, and it diverts people to the avenue that they need, rather than criminalizing it and sending them further down the shitter. Let's face it, because something I think you may have alluded to earlier, Robin, you know, when you were talking about, or it may have been in the TLDR episode, you know, people that come to you guys might already be having problems with money. So if you charge them for your services, they're really screwed. Obviously you're familiar with Judge Cheryl and her brilliant work in Nevada. Mm-hmm. Are there any plans for that kind of thing in your part of the world? Does it exist already?
Well, it's actually something that came up yesterday during our advocacy day. We talked a little bit about, you know, in this comprehensive plan, hopefully down the road, that is something that can be included in New York State. You know, because it's, the work that Judge Cheryl has done has just been incredible. And, you know, it could very well work in New York State. And we can, we can stop, you know, criminalizing people who have a serious issue with gambling and get them the treatment and help that they need.
Going back to the holistic approach as well, I mean, what are the sort of, obviously everybody is different in some ways, but I would think there are probably broad commonalities in the people that come to you. In that, I mean, are you seeing a lot of people with gambling problems that have other substance abuse issues, for example? Is alcohol a major player? Is illegal narcotics, is that a major player? What are some of the key drivers, would you say?
Well, I would say there's a few things that co-occur with a gambling problem. And like you were just saying, substance use disorder is one of them. But even bigger than that, I would say, is mental health issues co-occur quite heavily with problem gambling. So again, when people come into our services, they have to present with a gambling problem. But again, the person is treated as a whole person while they're working with one of the specialists. And, you know, you have to treat all these things at the same time. They can't really be separated out. So it needs to be a whole person approach. So mm-hmm. yes, those things are all addressed with someone who's coming into treatment. Because again, our goal is really to help people find, you know, a healthy way of being again, to function wholly again in society is really our goal. Like I think we said in the beginning, but just one more time, like our two biggest goals as an agency are to just raise awareness and to help people get connected to treatment services. So that's where we focus, especially Amy and I, because, you know, like we said, we work at the local level. This is really where we focus the majority of our efforts, while the New York Council is tasked with, you know, helping the state put better guidelines in place for all the gambling expansion that's happening. And I'd like to say, I feel all the resource centers across the state, there's seven of them. That's also something that we didn't get a chance to cover yet. So pretty much anywhere that you live in New York State, in New York City is covered with these resource centers where you can have treatment provided for you.
I mean, it actually sounds like you're really well set up. I was expecting to hear a story of, you know, you're woefully underfunded. Don't get me wrong. I know everybody could do with more funding.
Sure.
But actually, it sounds like you've got the structure in place, you've got the plan in place, and you're just
yes,
kicking absolutely. Ass.
Absolutely. Well,
every day.
Much credit to New York Council on Problem Gambling. So, you know, they've been working on this for close to a decade. It was 8 years ago that they launched a pilot program, the very first of one of these resource centers. It was called the Queen Center for Excellence in New York City. But again, they just saw the need. They saw people slipping through the cracks. You know, people were calling helpline numbers to try to get assistance for their gambling issue. And it was a very low rate. I think it was about 13% of people were, you know, calling in for help that were then actually getting into treatment. And wow. So the council just, you know, stepped in and built up this beautiful program because they were like, that's not okay. We can't have people slipping through the cracks. You know, there's a really high rate of suicide for people affected by problem gambling, the highest of any addiction. One mm-hmm. in five people attempt or complete suicide. So again, this is just something that New York State decided it's unacceptable. And there's people out there that are struggling. And we serve those people. That is why this council exists. And this is why the resource centers exist.
Super. Fintan, who was that lovely bloke we had on?
We had the lovely Keith White from yes. NCPG. And it'd be interesting. So there's a couple of things he brought up that I thought were really interesting. One was the increase of calls they saw coming in from people day trading. And he said mm-hmm. it reminded him of the early kind of dot-com day trading boom that happened many years ago and was kind of a wave. Is that something you guys are seeing as well?
Yeah, that is definitely something that we're educating our providers about. Because again, it's so many things I agree are being rolled out so quickly. I mean, going hand in hand with day trading is cryptocurrency.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
People wanting to get in on the front end of that to be the next millionaire, billionaire. So yeah, and it's a fine line, you know, between day trading and it again becoming a problem where it's a gambling issue for people. So this is something that we definitely stay on top of, keep our network informed. And yes, we've definitely seen an increase in calls related to those two things that we just were talking about, both day trading and cryptocurrency.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And I suppose I was thinking as well, like how closely do you guys work with operators? Are they like, do you speak to them on a regular basis or is it everything's done at an arm's length? How does that work?
Amy, yeah. Amy, take this one because she's done a beautiful job for our team of keeping us in with regulators.
Yeah, so really, you know, again, for what we do, we approach it more at the local level. So, you know, within our 15 counties, we have, you know, a handful of gaming facilities, and we really, you know, try to approach it as them, you know, as a partnership. How can we support them? Because we know there are people that go visit those facilities that, you know, really need our help and our services. So this, you know, this past January, we went in and did, a whole series of trainings for the security staff. And, we've gone in, we drop off our materials so that when, people go seek out the security officers and, we'll say things like, I can't do this anymore. I need help. I need to stop. I want to self-exclude from this facility. Help me through this process. They can, in turn, give out our information. So hopefully we can connect with those folks and, offer them some treatment options if it interests them and we can help support them. So we very much try to support our gaming facilities in our region.
And I would like to just, add to that at the state level, the New York Council on Problem Gambling worked with, we just had signed by the governor, Kathy Hochul. She just signed into effect that when people now voluntarily self-exclude at a gaming facility, they will be handed treatment materials. And this, the self-exclusion material is now going to be placed at all ATMs and all entrances and exits. So again, it's just increasing the visibility for those that are most heavily impacted by gambling and need to self-exclude mm-hmm. from the facilities. It's just, again, making those materials more accessible and making sure that people know that treatment is there and they're trying to make it easier for people to find. So that was a big win as far as we're concerned in New York State. So we appreciated that.
Fantastic. Is there any kind of, when we look ahead to the new online brands that'll be launching next year, are there any requests of them you want to make?
Well, I think it goes again with, when someone, when someone is flagged as, seeking out help, whether it's through some sort of self-exclusion on their platform, or maybe running into some issues, we just ask that they loop them back to the New York Council so we can get them connected to services.
Got it. And if any listeners wanted to support your work directly, can they make donations directly to your organization, or does it work like that?
Yeah, no, we don't take donations since we, again, are a state-funded or grant-funded program. But, we are really calling on people to help us with advocacy. So, we have mm-hmm. a new website that, again, we launched on November 1st. So I would encourage anyone who wants to see more about what we're doing or wants to work with us in partnership to go to strongerthanyouthinkny.org. And you can see all the different ways that you can join the cause just to help protect, again, those that are most vulnerable. So those are people with, a gambling issue or youth. We definitely, would like to keep youth safe as well where that's concerned. Mm-hmm. And again, we just ask that if, these mobile sports betting companies, if they could just contribute 3% of advertising budget for those counter ads to promote responsible gambling and resources for people with a gambling problem, then again, that's something that we highly encourage as best practice.
Fantastic. I love it. Thank you.
Truth. Amy, Robin, thank you both very much for joining us and telling us about your work.
And thank you for your work. It's a fantastic, it's real work. It's amazing what you guys are doing.
Thank you. And if you couldn't tell already, Robin and I are very passionate about the work we do. And, we wake up every day and go into this, just wanting to help anyone that is facing a problem with gambling and help their families and help people get better and help them heal. And that's what gets us going in every day. So we're very passionate about this work.
Yes. And the business of saving lives. We love what we do. And thank you so much, John and Fintan, for having us on so we can share with the world what we're doing. We appreciate your time.
No worries.
We're now going to go on to our next guest, Dr. Seamus Murphy. He is a lecturer in criminology at the University of Bedfordshire. He's going to be talking to us today about a lot of things. One of the key ones is his new book, The Casino and Society in Britain. And I'll let Seamus explain the book. And I think we'll also look a little bit ahead as well to some of the stuff that's happening in the future. So Seamus, writing a book about the history of casinos and society in the UK is quite a big undertaking. What led up to this? Like, you didn't just wake up one morning and go, "I've got to write this book." What was the thought process behind it?
Okay, well, the thought process was a bit of sort of disillusionment. I was working in casinos in the UK and had been for about 20 to 25 years at this point. And the first child of my family came along, firstborn, as they say, and I decided, well, it's time now maybe that I don't particularly want to see him watching me working nights going into a casino for the rest of my life. I'd prefer to have a more normalized environment for him to grow up in. So I decided to re-educate myself. And as part of that process, when it came to my dissertation undergrad, I was talking to one of my lecturers about the raids on the casinos in the 80s. So Playboy and Ladbrokes, the blood on the carpet, the casino wars, so to speak. And he said, "I'd much rather read a dissertation on that than another dissertation on the naval arms race of 1903 to 1914. And I went, "Oh, okay." So I looked into what documentation was around the casino wars and found there was, if you looked deep enough, there was good information out there. So I did a dissertation on it. And at that point, once I received my degree, my lecturers were pushing me to go on to further study, and they pushed me to go direct to PhD because I achieved the first, which meant I didn't have to do a master's. I could go straight to PhD. And the University of Luton at the time, despite the many disparaging thoughts people have about Luton, had the highest research grading for an historical institute in Britain at the time. So I was accepted direct to PhD because I studied at Luton by de Montfort. And essentially, I just expanded it out from an original dissertation project. But if you really know why I went for it, I actually ordered a couple of books online via the library service to bring in to read about the casino industry. There was a couple of books, I won't say who by. Well, when I read them, I realized not one of these guys had ever set foot in a casino, because there was just information in there that clearly, you know, to me, knew that they did not understand, one, the mechanics of gambling. And therefore, I thought, I got quite angry about it because it had been my life profession for a very long time. So I decided to do something about it. And hence, I pitched for the PhD to be based on this, A Social History of Gaming. And it was accepted. And that's essentially what the book evolved into.
So I always also love to know about people's, how they got started in the industry. So some people are kind of born into it. It's like a generational thing. And then other people kind of stumble into it by accident. Which camp are you in?
Oh, mine was generational. My mother was the first female general manager of a casino in Britain. So she started work at what was then Caesar's Palace, which was run by Ladbrokes in 1970. And then eventually became the general manager there many years later. And I grew up under Thatcherism, where there weren't that many options job-wise. And one of the things you find in times of depression is that actually gambling gets a significant lift. And she actually got me into a training school, and I trained as a croupier in her casino. And then immediately I was sent elsewhere because you couldn't work with relatives effectively. So I was generational, in a way.
Fantastic. So with we kind of talked, we joked about a little bit before we started recording that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And obviously, you know, you've written the history book on the industry, and we're looking ahead, or the UK is very much in the process of reviewing the Gambling Act. What can we learn from past mistakes or past successes?
Well, there's a majority of mistakes, and there's a minority of successes, I'd say. What you can learn is that you can't prohibit gambling. It's the same with alcohol. If there's a demand for a service, whether it be gambling, sex, or alcohol, the vices, so to speak, drugs, if people can't get them through legitimate means, they'll go down the illegitimate path. So prohibition and over-regulation is dangerous. because you can create criminal entrepreneurs will create a criminal industry to counter it. And that's what the history of gambling is all about. It's like thrust and counter thrust from criminal elements. The government will come in prejudiced by ideology and religion, will put in some harsh laws to control the feckless and the clumsy working class who don't have the intelligence to look after their own money. That's their viewpoint. So in 1906, for instance, they banned off course street betting on horse racing. That led to the street bookmaker and the bookies runner. And that was a working class industry, an illegal working class industry that was developed from within the working class for the working class by working class bookies. And it was arguably, I'd say, as honest, if not more honest, than the current industries. So again, the government's counter, but they can never quite shirk or let go of their prejudices. So they, every time they try and draft something, there'll be either something that's over prejudicial or there's a caveat to their own people. So if you look at the 1960 Act could have been quite an efficient act of stopping gambling, but they didn't want their gentlemen clubs like White's and Crockford's, etc., running into trouble with the law. So they left in a thing about session charges so that they could still gamble for high stakes amongst themselves, but no one else could. And what criminal entrepreneurs do, they identified that session charge and they developed what is now the modern casino industry was developed from exploiting that actual session charge. One, I think the wording was about 4 or 5 letters long in the actual 60 Act that led to the effective establishment of the casino industry in the UK. So to counter that, those mistakes, I'd say the 68 Act probably got it down quite well. The 68 Act, I'd say, was one of the most successful gambling regulatory pieces written. It managed the casino industry from a principle of unstimulated demand, which means you couldn't advertise, you couldn't seek out your custom, the custom had to seek you. And at the same time, it was class prejudicial because arguably the Labour Party, who were initiating the 68 Act, didn't want the working class in casinos. They're quite happy for the working class to have their bingo and their bookmakers' offices, which were legalised in 1960. But they didn't want the working class in casinos. So they developed the regulatory structure around the 1968 Act to effectively exclude working class people. So one, you couldn't drink and gamble at the same time. So you'd have separate entrances for the restaurant and the bar and the gaming floor. So you couldn't take alcohol on the gaming floor. Two, you couldn't just walk in off the street. There was a 48-hour waiting period where you'd have to apply for membership from the casino, and then the casino could decide whether they took you as a member. And these are all designed to stop the working class man, say, on a Friday evening, coming out of their local pub, fueled up on a little bit of alcohol as they would be, coming down the road, passing a casino and think, oh, I'll try my luck in here, and waking up the next morning without their wages. And that was a very effective tool. It created an environment in the British casino industry, in a vast majority of casinos, where it was there for the local middle class and for ethnic groups as opposed to the white working class. So there are successes in the history of gambling, but largely they are only put in place after the failures emerge and start to really cause damage. And I think we're seeing that with the current modern review that, the pressure's grown now for some form of review for whatever reason. But one thing I would like to point out, within all of this, they never actually take into consideration the actual gambler. That's gone backwards. The 60 and the 68 Acts looked towards working class gambling and gambling in general and didn't see it in the prejudicial manner it had been seen with before from a religious perspective or from a feckless perspective. They acknowledged that working class gambling was almost like an intellectualized process for some working class people and that they weren't gambling to ruin. So now I think they've lost sight of that, some of the regulators. I know there are issues with the industry and with all the usual thing, and we can talk about that for hours. That's not why we're here. But the point is that the point they have, because they're having a review, shows there are mistakes within that initial legislation. So, you know, the review itself says there's something wrong.
So if you were writing the legislation, mm-hmm. What would you change based on your research?
Well, I'd actually fund the proper inspectorate. So let's not forget, I don't know how badly austerity hit, you know, the Gambling Commission, but I did hear at one point that they lost 40% of their funding as an organisation. And they have not got sufficient resources to conduct their duties, full stop. Everyone criticises them for whatever, you know, mistakes they are deemed to have made. And there is an aggressive anti-gambling lobby that's developed in the UK. And it's put the industry on the defensive. Now, I understand, you know, the harm that has been caused, but that doesn't alter the fact that to attack a regulator that hasn't got the sufficient resources to do their job is, you know, you're directing your anger in the wrong direction. I think that the focus should be a properly funded commission as opposed to a review of the legislation.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. It's practical, it's simple. Simple always beats complex. Mm-hmm. And I do agree as well. I think the industry definitely hasn't helped itself. There's, you know, it's I've talked about this before. It's too easy for the Daily Mail or the Guardian to get a story where the IT team have failed and stuff. But
I think the industry is on the defensive. It has been too defensive. I mean, there's clearly been abuses, I would say, from within the industry in how they, particularly how they target players, you know, lifetime values. We talk about LTVs and all the other things that we have in the remote sector when we're looking at, you know, the worth of the player. And I think there has been abuses there. And yeah, that's not, don't hide your abuses, fix them, is one point I'd make. The other one is that don't lose track that arguably 96-97% of all gamblers do not develop an issue with gambling. I mean, you know, it is a leisure pastime for a vast majority of players. And in the current debate that we're having with this sort of approach from, as you said, the Daily Mail, et cetera, these sort of media outlets that are supporting this quite a prohibitionist approach, and then the defences of the injury, stuck in the middle are people who just want to have a bit of a flutter. And they're the ones who are really not even being considered in this argument. And I worry that the prohibitionist side I think it would be slightly unjustified to maybe describe them as prohibitionists. But let's just say those who are trying to curb the excesses of the industry will be given too much gravitas and have too much weight in this argument that will really affect the people stuck in the middle. And again, at that point, this is a danger when when there was talk about restricting deposit limits to £10 per player or stakes to £10 a player. If they can't get it legally, they'll get it illegally. Pure and simple. So it's really is a balancing act. But in the middle there, the vast majority of players do so from a leisure perspective. It can only be argued as a leisurely pursuit. It is not damaging to them, damaging to their families, and they don't have a voice in this debate currently.
I 100% agree. We're in complete agreement on that.
Yeah.
So back to the book for a minute. You must have some good stories in the book. What's your favorite story?
Well, some of the favorite stories I had to leave out. But
can we get the ones you left out then? Can we do that?
This is an industry only podcast, so
yeah. So I'm just trying to think of one that's actually broad. Well, I can tell you how. You know, I mean, in the book, I don't know if I explain why it's gangsters, Ponces and thieves. On the dice table at the Vic, we used to have a clientele that were consistent. Daily, always in. And they really were a rogues gallery. And there was one of them who was a professional photographer, a really pleasant fella. And he was talking about a particular guy of quite notoriety from the East End of London in the war. And that he'd been actually, I think he'd won the George Cross because he'd been out cat burgling during the Blitz and a bomb hit a house with family in. And he went in and dragged the family out and then the house collapsed on him. So when he woke up in the hospital with a crushed skull and a plate in his head or whatever they did to save his life, there was two CID officers at the end of the bed who sort of said, we're going to ignore what's in this bag that we found you with because of what you've done, but we don't want to see you doing this again. And they walked off, and he ended up with the George Medal. Now, and he was apparently a very charismatic guy and a really pleasant fella. But George said that he was completely surrounded. Everywhere he gambled, he was surrounded by gangsters, ponces, and thieves. And I looked around the dice table at the time and I thought, well, that's what's around the dice table. In the Vic, that was the clientele of the Vic at the time. Gangsters, Ponces and Thieves, you know. And I just thought to myself, okay, well, that's why that title came about. But within it, there was, if you just take a look at the stuff on the raids on the Vic, it was hilarious. I mean, we had one particular guy who wasn't employed because he knew gaming inside out. He was employed because he'd been a jeweler in his previous, you know, he'd had a jewelry business. And his job was solely to value the jewelry hanging around the necks of the women and on the fingers of the women that the rich Arab clientele were bringing in to gamble with them, because they weren't allowed to supposed to give credit, but that didn't stop them. And they would sort of be, you know, taking this jewellery from these Arab guys and giving them credit to carry on gambling, and they put the jewellery in the safe with a ticket, and when they were back in, they could buy back the jewellery, you know. Everything they did at the Vic at this period of time was against the law, you know. There was drugs in the safe. They were avoiding paying tax. They were paying dealers cash in hand on their overtime shifts. I mean, it was there was a great line somewhere in the law where, you know, a place must not become the habitual haunt of criminals or prostitution. Well, the Vic at that period, that's all that was in there, you know. So you had these sort of stories that emerged, all character driven, all, you know, papered over, say, thinly, the abuses by the gaming board at the time. So, I mean, ask me anything. How do people cheat? How do we used to catch them? On a dice table, cheating was part of the game. So, essentially, it was such a hard game to supervise because there's multiple bets, multiple activity on the table, that the customers believed that cheating was part of the game, particularly our Greek clientele. So what actually developed was, dice dealers became institutionalized by dice. In the end, they couldn't deal anything else because they were so aggressive, they'd get into trouble. So you were kept on the dice table. It was like a life sentence. If you became a decent dice dealer, that was it. You were nailed onto that table until the day you died. And it was aggression. It was a constant source of aggression. And, you know, now and again, they'd pull a stroke. We used to call cheating pulling a stroke. They'd pull a stroke. They'd get away with it. And you knew they'd done it. You knew. And, you know, they'd smile at it and you'd think, right, you know. And there was ways and means we'd get back at them. But, I mean, it was like, just like constant low-intensity warfare. And some of these guys that come in were quite terrifying. But when they came on the table, if you dealt to them in a manner that was good for them and, you know, you knew their action, how you're going to deal with their action, they'd be the first to protect you when someone would kick off on the table against you. And these would be, you know, bank robbers, all sorts, you know. So at the Vic, those periods, there was all sorts of abuses going on. There was one where the guy who was supposed to be in charge of the club squad or the licensing structure of the club squad in London at the time used to come into one gaming club. He'd immediately be sent a girl or a couple of girls over by the owner. He'd have a meal, get drunk, and then he'd retire upstairs to the flat above the club with these girls. And that was the sort of, you know, the senior CID officer for whatever section that was in London. So, you know, all of these abuses were occurring in the 60s and the build up to the 68 Act. It was all, it was like a Wild West scenario. And then it was countered slightly by the emergence of groups such as Playboy and Ladbrokes. So Victor Lowndes' Playboy, Cyril Steen's Ladbrokes, they saw it from a more professional perspective. They realized how much money they could make from gambling. And they kind of developed a professional side to it. So so when it came to legitimizing the industry under the 68 Act, effectively 75% of the industry just disappeared overnight. By the end of all the due diligence processes conducted by the gaming board, 20% of the industry may have been left, a tiny proportion, even less than that. And it emerged from archives of the interviews they were having with people like Judah Binstock and everyone else. I mean, that they did well in targeting certain groups. They seemed to know the ones to get rid of, and Binstock was a danger to gambling as far as they were concerned. So they targeted Binstock. He took a step back, but money was still going to Binstock. I worked in Archer Street in Soho at the time, a place called Charlie Chester's that was owned by an Indian family just prior to I might be working there. And a Rolls Royce used to arrive every week, and two suitcases would be brought into the club, and then these two very heavy brute suitcases would be brought back out, put in the back of this Rolls Royce and driven to Heathrow. And they'd end up in India. And then you're talking about times of, you know, currency restrictions. But this was still occurring under a legalized, supposedly regulated industry. So there's all sorts of stories that can be emerge and talk. I mean, but the industry didn't change overnight. When a new regulation came in, it worked its way through slowly. But you do have to question the gaming board for what occurred at the Vic, in particular at the Victoria, between sort of 1969 and 1978. What was going on there? There was an enforcement gap there. The types of abuses, well, the cocaine, the girls, the jewellery in the fridges, the tax evasion, the cash payouts, etc. All of that was going on. That there was supposed to be an inspectorate enforcing, you know, the law and making sure that didn't carry on. I couldn't prove it, and I never will be able to prove it, but I did suggest that there was what I described as in the book an enforcement gap. But essentially, I think that there was someone in the gaming board wasn't doing their job possibly for a monetary reason. And it was, you know, it should have been detected, and it wasn't. So, yeah. So, I mean, there's multiple stories. There's loads of stuff I can tell you. There's loads of stuff I can't particularly tell you that is more focused on how the croupier views the customer. Yeah, you know, Laurie the Limp, he got his limp from jumping over Dartmoor Prison, you know, came over the wall, landed on, broke his leg. He was it Laurie the Limp? Something the Limp. Anyway, he used to be the habitual setting in the Victoria Bar because he was a moneylender. And, he'd get up and he'd limp around, and anyone who needed cash on the game floor, go see Laurie the Limp, whatever, you know. This was all occurring, you know. So all of these things like the habitual haunt of criminals, the habitual haunt of prostitution, the gaming, no credit should be allowed, etc. All of that was just, you know, at the Vic, it was just like, oh, don't worry about that. Just get on with it, you know. That sort of approach.
It does sound like really good fun.
It's great fun. Don't get me wrong. I was in there for 28 years. I'd have probably killed myself if I, you know, was a punter banco dealer constantly, or, you know, I mean, I was trained on all games, but I specialised on dice. The difference in the casinos was, you know, you worked as a crew on dice. So you'd work together, five of you on a crew. And there's a lot of fun to be had, but two, it, you know, the observation side of it from when you're observing people, you know, I mean, it was a great laugh. It was a good laugh, but you know, and a good environment to work in for a very long time until the usual things occur, which is, you know, the old neoliberalism, the deregulation, you know, everything that the industry wants, the industry gets, forget about what the staff want. You know, that sort of approach. You know, I love this term when they go on about, oh, liberalisation and removing of regulatory barriers and all this unnecessary stuff that we don't need, you know, that you get under neoliberalism where they strip it all out. But yeah, that's all done for the benefit of the corporates and the owners. You know, the staff never benefited. So eventually, you know, the vast majority of people who could have stayed in the industry longer started to leave if they could, because the job was being eroded year after year after year. And it's a shame, because it was a great environment to work in.
So obviously this was kind of the, you know, it sounds like you said, Wild West, wild fun kind of type scenario. But then obviously things changed, right? So the Gaming Act would have been enforced. You've talked about raids and stuff. Well, what was it like afterwards?
Well, you had really an emasculated industry. So you went from a totally unregulated industry where you could have mixed entertainment, the cabaret on the gaming floor, alcohol on the gaming floor, restaurants on the gaming floor, you know, those type of cabaret clubs, which would have been a distinctive model if they hadn't been touched, to British gambling, slightly different to the American model. You know, the focus was on cabaret. The gaming was used to subsidize the cabaret and have a little bit of profit as well. So essentially, that's how the gaming was developing in the UK. And arguably, that's the model that probably would have developed into if left unregulated. What the 68 Act did was turn it into a sterile environment. So you went from a very colourful environment with all of the colourful characters, etc., to a sterile environment, full stop. And within that process, staff were discouraged to be friendly. We weren't encouraged to have conversations with the players or to be nice to them. We lost our tips because the management were taking 40% of the tips, or taking, you know, a big large portion of the tips for the croupiers, and the gaming board said, well, you know, those tips for the croupiers, they should go to the croupiers, and the managers refused. So the gaming board said, right, nobody gets tips. So they removed tipping. So essentially it became a professional business, because they had to increase the salary to keep the staff. Now, when you remove tips, you lost a substantial part of your revenue, so the casinos had to start paying more in salary. But it became a very sterile environment, very conservative is the only word for it. You know, beige, very beige. There was no colour in the environment. There was no, you know, you had no music playing. All you could hear were the dropping of roulette balls, or the spread of the cards, or the dice being thrown, and the odd shout from the dice table. So a very colourless environment that was created under the 68 Act, but it was a very effective piece of legislation. And despite the anomaly of what occurred at the Vic, the gaming board moved on the casinos in what we called casino wars. The casino wars didn't develop because the gaming board detected breaches. The casino wars developed because Cyril Steen despised Victor Lowndes, and Victor Lowndes despised Cyril Steen. So you had a blood in the carpet sort of approach. Ladbrokes did some very idiotic stuff, in particular employing a really dodgy character from, I think he was originally Dutch, who essentially was a pimp from what I can make out, and later on was a person of interest in a number of murders. God knows what Cyril Steen was thinking. He employed him as part of his sort of marketing department. And they had this crazy setup called Operation Unit 6, where they were corrupting police officers to get the addresses off license plates of high-end vehicles pulling up outside their rival casinos, which generally were Playboy. You know, and so you had these weird things that developed under it. You know, there was no need for the casinos to go to war at all. There was plenty of money, petrodollars. You know, you're talking back in late 70s, people coming in and losing $1 million in a night, £1 million in a night. You know, this is back in the 70s. So, you know, there was so much money slopping around London. There was no need to go to war, but Cyril Steen just got greedy and decided he wanted more, and he went about it in an illegal manner. So once the game board became aware of that, they moved. And then they moved on Playboy, not because Playboy was doing anything wrong, but because Cyril Steen sent a dodgy dossier to the gaming board about what Playboy had been up to. And Playboy probably would have survived if they'd had more intelligent leadership. Victor Lowndes and Bill Gerhauser, who were in control of the British operation, were very intelligent, very smart. But Playboy's demise in the UK came about because of their Chicago management, who are complete and utter idiots. And also, whoever advised them in the UK, you know, should have lost their license if they were a lawyer anyway, because gave them incredibly bad advice. But what it gave was the impression of a powerful regulatory force that will strip multi-million pound corporations of their licenses. And that is really powerful. And from that point onward, from that sort of the end of the 1970s and the early 1980s, from that point onward, everybody who really had a vested interest in keeping their business ran it extremely clean, you know, very clean. They were basically terrified of the gaming board after this point.
Got it. So it's, you know, you use one to terrify the many type scenario, which is...
Well, yeah, and the whole thing that really is the point, like I've already stated, is the fact that, you know, the gaming board weren't terrified. They didn't discover these issues. These issues were sort of leaked to them by other groups, you know. So when they did go on the offensive after that, they decided to, you know, okay, step it up a little bit. But effectively, they were being used by Ladbrokes in an act of revenge when it comes to Playboy. So, yeah. So,
do you think that the Gambling Commission now has a similar sort of clout?
I managed to get almost to the end
of that sentence before I left.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of, I've met a lot of the people who work for the Gambling Commission, and they're in a no place to hide scenario. They can't go anywhere. They're just in the spotlight, but it's not their fault. You know, they're an underfunded organisation. It's the neoliberal approach. It's this great concept that they wheel out called self-regulation, which means, yeah, go on, help yourself, boys. There's no one around to see you. You know, that's essentially what it is. I mean, self-regulation does not work. I don't care what they say. You know, it does not work. And they've relied upon that concept of self-regulation through licensing conditions of practice, the remote technical standards, and all the things that we have to deal with if we're running a B2C or a B2B business in the remote sector in particular. And, you know, it doesn't work. You need a rigid enforcement. You need someone to come in and say, let me in. I'm coming here to inspect you. And that's what the casinos had to deal with. We could not turn away a gaming board inspector if they wanted to come into the building unless it was an unreasonable request, which meant if it was 3:45 in the morning, 15 minutes before we closed, and the gaming board inspector wanted entry, we'd say no. But if they came at 2:00 a.m, you let them in. You know, they were allowed back a house. They were allowed into your cash desk. They could inspect your records. They wouldn't announce it. And it would go around the casino like Goldfire. They'd just say, gaming board are in, gaming board are in, gaming board are in. Everybody would hear within 2 minutes that they were in, and everything stiffened up. Everything became more disciplined, even though we weren't doing anything wrong. You know, it's that concept of when you look at a policeman, you feel guilty. You know, that's the effect that the gaming board inspectors had in casinos. You know, they walked in, you felt guilty. So you need that sort of rigid, irregular inspection apparatus, I think, to really keep people on their toes. I mean, the industry is vast in the UK now, and that would take a lot of manpower. But I do think that if they focused on, say, some of the larger groups or the bigger firms to ensure that they're doing the right thing, that would have a trickle-down effect from a fear capacity. You know, if you can get into someone, and I'm not saying anyone's doing anything wrong here, but if you can get into Bet365, if you turn up on a Monday at, you know, 2:00 in the afternoon, they say, how are you? I'm from the Gambling Commission. I've come here to speak to some of your people. And they cannot deny you access. You go in there and you target, say, their compliance guy and said, let me see your last audit. What's happening over here? Can I speak to your head of, like, customer service relations, please? You know, that it would be effective, in my opinion. Self-regulation just doesn't work.
I agree. And I think we've seen, you know, there's yeah, look, I think it's as simple as that. My other question, because just with your book, so obviously you've touched on it a little bit at the beginning. So you kind of talk about where there's a prohibition, a vacuum is created and criminals kind of step in. And then your stories about the Victoria Club and things like this as well. There's clearly a huge overlap between the two. Is it the 1968 Act then, when kind of everything got cleaned up and the industry sorted itself out, or has that criminal element kind of maintained and kind of is just more hidden, or like how has that worked out over time?
I'd argue that the land-based sector, so land-based casinos, you know, London, whatever, your local G Club in Brighton or Luton, whatever, they are effectively crime-free, and they're not under any criminal influence. So that's not because of the 2007 Act, that's because of the 68 Act. So from that perspective, the 68 Act worked. I mean, there were abuses afterwards, like, as I was saying, at the Vic. So from, like I said, 69 to 78, the Vic was doing all sorts of nonsense. And then you had the casino wars. But the 68 Act was really effective, and the gaming board were very effective. And that's what cleaned up the industry. Also, you had the concept that you weren't allowed foreign ownership. So you had to be an English-based company to run casinos. Playboy got round of that by setting up a trust, but the trust was effectively monitored. And it's also why Playboy lost its licenses, not because of malpractice. It lost its licenses because the idiots from Detroit or Chicago came over and sacked Victor Lowndes and Bill Gerhauser, turned up to a licensing hearing on the Monday morning after sacking them. The magistrates and the gaming board official who was there, police basically said, "Who are you?" And they said, "Oh, we are so-and-so. We're from Playboy Detroit, and we're now running, you know, Playboy over here." And they said, "Where is Victor Lowndes?" And we've removed him. He's sacked. He's no longer employed by Playboy. And they said, "Okay, well, that's an exercise of foreign control over a British-based company. And you've lost all your licenses." And at that point, they lost every single casino license they had in the country. So that was the power the game board had. And that scarred the minds of many CEOs and high-ranking officials within existing casino groups that survived, that to make sure that they never put a foot wrong.
But now it seems that, you know, some regulators are almost bending over backwards to appear toothless. But we were talking about one a few weeks ago, Fintan, I don't know if you remember, but we were talking about the, it was Crown in Australia, and they were found unfit to operate their license. So they were penalized by being allowed to continue operating.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You're either fit or you're unfit. I mean, it's kind of an absolute.
Yeah, I think Australia's can we draw comparisons for Australia? I remember speaking to an Australian psychologist who was looking at gambling harm. And he told me that essentially Crown got their licenses because their argument was to the state government, "We'll make you the most money." And that's how it got through. I think it's a process. The license distribution in Australia wasn't based on, say, more stringent lines that you get, say, in the UK. And when you come to enforcement, I mean, how does the Gambling Commission, say, in the UK, hold a rod of enforcement? They don't seem to have anything at the moment. Displaying any sort of offensive weaponry. I mean, they fine companies that treat fines as an operating cost. You know, until they actually remove someone's license for some form of breach, I don't think they're ever going to have enough force in the minds of the operators to really sort of draw them into line.
I only recently learned as well that fines and that don't go into the commission at all. They just go into sort of your general government coffers. So there isn't even that incentive. You know, crap, we need new chairs. Who can we fine?
I mean, it's like, I mean, there is the issue of that. I mean, there's that small Florida township police force that has about 7 guys who police officers and has a sort of operational sort of reserve of 58 million or something, because they keep seizing these cigarette boats coming in from the cartels full of money and, you know, cocaine. And purpose being that what they seize goes then to fund their department. Now, it's great for them as a small police force, but it's a very good illustration of what the commission should be able to do, which is, yeah, if they fine someone, you know, £750,000 for breaches, that should go back into their budget. That should be returned to them so they can employ widen the inspectorate.
Well, realistically, it needs a baseline budget with which they can operate with reasonable effectiveness, which is topped up in their powers or their personnel extended by whatever's recouped in fines until a point when they don't need it anymore.
Yeah. Just saying. And also, I do think that there's other issues, though, with the commission. I do think there's legacy issues from the time of the 68 Act, in that you had a very very professional and knowledgeable inspectorate in London under the Gaming Board. When they were going to move the commission to Birmingham, I think they lost the vast majority of that knowledge, probably 90% of it. I don't know how many inspectors switched to Birmingham, but a lot of people weren't going to move from London to Birmingham. And so from the start, they've lost a lot of knowledge there and a lot of understanding of the business. And also, I met civil servants. I remember one time the Vic, which was Grosvenor Casinos at the time, had brought in a couple of politicians who wanted to see the place. And one girl who I'd met at a Society for the Study of Gambling meeting recognised me and came over to talk to me. I was inspecting a roulette at the time, a dead table, and we were chatting. And she was saying to me, I said, so you're going to take this job at the commission? Because she said she'd been offered to it. She goes, yeah. She says, I'll do that probably for 2 years and then I'll see what comes along. Well, in the day of the gambling board, you know, you'd have gaming board inspectors who stayed there for 30 years. So the actual mechanics, inner workings of the sort of civil service itself, how they sort of market, you know, make a market, commodify their own employees, and, you know, means that, yeah, you do 2 years with commission, then that 2 years experience and knowledge is gone because they've applied for a job now working for the Department of Health or something. Whereas the gaming board was like a separate sort of structure within the whole entire process. And that's what you need to do with the commission. You need to structure it so that it doesn't have to worry about losing its staff to other departments. You maintain them and they build that knowledge and they understand the business more effectively and they understand the regulations more effectively. And they then therefore, presumably, regulate and police the actual industry in a more efficient manner. But what do I know?
Exactly. What do you know?
Yeah. Yeah. What do I know?
Your fucking doctorate.
You know, take your doctorate and shove it up your ass, mate, as one Aussie once said. Yeah.
I can only say that they're right. Fintan might agree with you on everything you said. I agree with that going up your ass. I'm kidding, of course.
I hope that goes out of the way.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
we don't edit. We don't edit. It's fearless.
Let's just say we edit with a very light touch.
Yeah. Like the Gambling Commissions and their regulatory approach. Light touch editing with light touch regulation, yeah.
See, there's a theme. We're just going with the flow.
Yeah.
I've just been looking at your book on Amazon, right? Because in the interest of full disclosure, I totally haven't read it. But it seems a bargain at, can I say the price?
You can say the price if you want, yeah. This is the world academic publishing, yeah?
£130.
Yeah, that or you get it. No, if you look around, you get a right bargain at about £112.
Oh, that is good, yeah.
This is the world of academic publishing. They know that the book will be bought by all the libraries. So effectively, it's, you know, I understand how to play the game and I understand why the academic publishers do it. However, for me, from my perspective, there's crossover appeal in that book. It's not just an academic sort of resource. It's an entertaining read on an entertaining subject that people have a lot of interest in. I think a paperback version would do really well. But what I have to do to that is revisit it and put in, say, as Finland was saying earlier, can you tell me some of the stories you haven't put in the book? Well, I can, but that will be in the paperback version if I can get the paperback version out. So, yeah, Amazon, if you're going to buy the hard copy, forget about it. It's horrendous. I mean, you can get the ebook for about, if you're lucky, £28 or something, or you can rent it. You know, this is all geared to academia, to sort of maximize money in academia as opposed to the general public, which is a pity because it's a good read. Well, I'd say that anyway, but everyone who's read it has told me it's a good read.
All your family?
Yeah. The wife.
But, you know, but she's got a reputation for being hard, so that's
good. Yeah.
There is crossover. You're quite right, and I mean that's part of the reason we wanted you to come on the podcast and talk about it, because we realized that there was a slightly unique perspective here. You know, it's kind of the career history in the industry, and now you're a historian. I mean, it is pretty unique, I would say. I once met the world's only marmalade historian.
Oh, right. There you go. Not a jam myself, but.
Oh, no, this guy's stuff, though, different class.
Yeah.
No, I'm dead serious, right?
No.
I was working, I am going to digress a little here. I was working on Scotland magazine, and in the first issue, I was like, it was one of those, it was a very small team, so I was like literally doing everything. And the editor's like, right, so. We're going to do a back page article every issue, which is about something that's invented in Scotland, right? For whether whether you believe it's invented in Scotland or not, you know, you either debunk it or you praise it to the nines. First issue, we're going to do marmalade. I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake. Okay. So, one weekend, I'm sitting in the office on my own. Nobody else is working the weekend. I'm doing a bit of research, and the magazine was based in Norwich, obviously. It's a very long way from Scotland. And I find this dude who's like a marmalade historian. He's written a book on the history of fucking marmalade. I'm like, whoa, okay, I'm not going to have time to read that or even get that. This is quite a long time ago. It's a good 20 years ago. But I can email him. He was only living in Norwich. So he said, I'll come down. I'll come down and see you at work. And he brought these old marmalade pots and all this. And he explained the entire history of marmalade to me and why what we see as traditional marmalade is nothing to do with how it was actually made originally, because sugar would have been so scarce. So it would have been completely impossible to make it that way. And he recreated, this is the really cool part, he had recreated the cutting device that they would have used. They used the whole orange, so they used it for the pectin and everything as well, right? And I hate marmalade. I tried his stuff, and it is divine. And it's got like, it's cut really, really finely. It's got the outside of the oranges in it as well. And this is an inedible orange. It is beautiful.
So are you saying to me that Big Marmalade has been lying to me all of these years?
Through its fucking teeth.
Wow. Yeah.
And they've therefore they've really sort of groomed Paddington Bear as a selling piece.
Seriously, he's if you saw Paddington in real life, you would think he was on crystal meth. He's in that bad shape. If he'd been having the real thing, he'd be doing Iron Man everything. What was really interesting is he recreated this cutting device and was just making it in his cellar, and he was just selling it at the occasional car boot sale, And I'm like, this should be sold in friggin' Harrods. You're a historian. You've got the most unique story here. You know, I mean, it's just, it's a completely unique perspective. Like, his academic background, unlike yours, Seamus, gave it greater sort of credibility. It's brilliant. Love it.
Yeah.
Sorry, I really went down a rabbit hole there, didn't I?
it's a nice rabbit hole. It could be a lot worse.
But like Big Marmalade, though, they've got a lot to answer for. Yeah. And I'm glad they've got a name now. Thanks, Finton.
No worries.
Yeah. The evils of Big Marmalade. Yeah.
From Finton Amazon
series in 6 weeks.
Seriously, I'll probably disappear after this is published.
Oh. It's okay. There's a big long list of people who want to get us, John. Big Marmalade's just one of them. Seamus, I think we should say thank you for your time. I'm not going to lie. I bought the ebook. I didn't buy the hardback. We're not making Big Marmalade money over here. we got to work up to that. I'm really looking forward to reading it. So thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. And remember, if you've enjoyed listening to The Gambling Files, you can share with colleagues and friends, or share with the person that gave you COVID if you thought it was shit. You can like, subscribe. You can find past episodes on our website, www.thegamblingfiles.com. Feel free to leave comments and feedback, especially if it's good. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you soon.